have to be two readings. So they have to bring it, you know, once they have the wording, it gets a first reading, and then it comes back a week later for the second reading, and then once it's approved the second time, there's 30 days that people could go out and get signatures to stop it from going into effect and put it on the ballot.
But how many signatures
30
days
do you have to get? Is not much time to get thousands of signatures.
You need to get thousands?
Yeah, I think it's is it 10% of the people who voted in the most recent citywide election? So that would be like 4,000 signatures. It can be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impossible. But it's an enormous amount of work to do that in 1 month, especially, and that's why I think they're going to try to rush it in the summertime, because they know if they vote for it July 23rd, the month of August when everybody's on vacation, it's so hard to get people to sign. If they approve it in the fall when the students are back, most young people are not going to support things like this. Mm-hmm. So if they wait until the fall, we could probably get the signatures in a month, I would think. Mm. But in August, it's hard to get signatures. Because everybody, I mean, the people who would run around getting the signatures are going to be on vacation, and the people that you want to sign are going to be on vacation. So.
Is there a W away? To S T A stall it.
There are, you know, some technicalities that can sometimes slow things down, and those things might happen, perhaps. But you know, if the majority of the city council is insistent that something's important, and they basically moved this ahead of like 40 other things in order to rush it through last time.
Why?
Because it's a very emotional issue. The so-called moderates on the city council are gung-ho to do this. And, you know, I think this is the only bill that I can remember.
Why? Why are they gung-ho to do this, the moderates?
I think, you know, it's... I think to some extent they see it as a politically popular thing to protect the children, and even in a progressive area, you know, children are a very sensitive subject, and so, you know, they've talked about, you know, the playing fields issue as, you know, we need more playing fields for our children, which we do, and, you know, they talk about that not quite as passionately as this, but that's one that most people agree, that we do need playing fields, and it is good for children to have places to play on playing fields, but this, very few children are up, you know, after 10 o'clock at night in the first place. And, you know, depending on how young they are, you sort of have to wonder if their parents are letting, you know, little tiny kids be watching TV after 10 o'clock. You have to wonder if their parents are that irresponsible, why are they going to be any more responsible to make sure they're not watching it at 12 o'clock?
And O, L, older, D, S, olds, Betty Olds, M, A, makes it, C, L,
clear.
She. Don't want it not for the kids, but
for everybody.
B-E, because
it's wrong.
It is wrong because it, she don't like it.
Well, obviously, you know, we're starting to go down a very treacherous path in determining, you know, city council members determining what they don't like shouldn't be seen by anyone in the community, except at the time when most people are asleep. You know, that's a pretty dangerous path. There are some people who think that violence is far more dangerous, and people learn violence from television far more than they learn about sex.
Or
and so
C O M M E R commercialism.
Yeah, so
you learn that on television.
It's probably far more people die and get hurt and sick from, you know, imitating violence that they've watched on TV than anything that could ever happen to them from watching sex or anything related to sex.
News.
But that I'm not advocating that we should outlaw violence on television. You know, I don't think we should outlaw, you know, any of these kinds of things. So.
TV is not K I D kid
friendly.
S safe. TV is not kid safe.
Well, TV is one of the most powerful forces in our society. And, you know, I can remember, you know, watching television and learning lots of things that probably my adopted family didn't want me, you know, to learn. I mean, I became a Democrat, which was a radical thing to be a Democrat when you're surrounded by Republicans. And
they are they E R E S. They rested their case. After you turned Democrat, your family.
Well, they expressed pretty harsh disapproval, and so, you know, I think TV, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It can provide a lot of educational content. Some people have used television for sex education programs, for, you know, educating people about birth control, for educating people about women's right to choose, for, you know, there's many positive resources within the world of television, at the same time as it's predominantly controlled by the advertising and whatever the commercial world wants
that,
you know, to put forth.
Is why I S P sponsor Susie Block's program is the sex education aspect of it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that particular show, but
that's the show that everybody's freaking out about, her show and Frank's show. She's very smart. She's a doctor of philosophy, and she's very non-judgmental, and she takes call-ins, and she'll talk about anything anybody asks her in a non-judgmental, really even keel kind of way, and she's smart and down to earth, so she gives a lot of good advice to people. I mean, we think we're doing a good thing by making something like that available to people.
Well, just like when I was growing up, you know, the fact that I was a liberal, you know, was threatening because I was getting educated by ideas different than what I was being spoon-fed. People learning about sex and understanding sex can be threatening to people who are sex-phobic, and, you know, not only are they against pornography, they're against any, you know, if you mention something about being gay, you can tell certain people are very nervous. And even if you're talking about anything related to straight sex, some people get very nervous. And it's like it's still a taboo. Mm. Although it's probably the most frequently talked about subject when you're talking to your friends and you know, acquaintances in many ways. It and joked about on late night TV and all over the place. It's still phenomenally taboo to actually, other than sort of double entendres and sort of nuanced
stuff
jokes,
like you see on commercials.
Anything, you know, directly talking about it, and especially anything where you're being explicitly and educational about, you know, people learning about sex, is still, you know, considered scary and unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And you would think that the women's movement and, you know, and all of the women coming, you know, to terms with their sexuality as part of, you know, women's liberation, you know, there's a high percentage of people who have moved beyond those taboos and those fears and can accept it and to some extent embrace it.
Not in on the city council.
I actually think the majority of Berkeley is not as uptight as the city council.
Yeah, I would hope so.
I'm pretty sure of that.
So, but they're elected, right?
Well, partly I think there's a generational chasm. Mm-hmm. The majority of the city council are senior citizens, and the sexual revolution and beyond the sexual revolution, sort of, you know, anybody who's in their teens and 20s and 30s, you know, they've probably had more sex education, the people who are under 40, than, you know, in 1 year than many people who, you know, are twice as old as them. And I think this issue is one example of generational gaps between a city council, which is predominantly senior citizens, and I'm the youngest person on the city council, which is pretty shocking in itself, because I'm 47. and most of the people are way, you know, decades older than I am. I mean, that's a sad part of life, that most of the people in Berkeley are younger than me, and yet we can't get any of them to run for office because it's, you know, it's so much work and it's so poorly paid, and you have to put up with all the racial.
So
and
when you're on the city council, is that like your job? Like, do you have to have another job, or can you support yourself being on the city council?
If you have a family and a mortgage, or even really if you have a rent to pay, you can't really live on the salary of city council. Until Donna Spring proposed the recent raise, it was $11,000 a year, and now with her increase, it's up to $22,000. So it's no longer, you know, absolute starvation wages, but, you know, if you try to do a good job and work at it full time,
right,
you know, $20,000 is barely enough to pay your rent and your food, and you don't have an awful lot of time to go out and have fun and go to the movies and theaters and concerts
and
or whatever else you want to do.
After seeing what the council meetings are like, is that it? Yeah, it was horrifying.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of hostility.
Yeah,
towards people, towards each other on the council.
It seemed like people couldn't even talk to each other civilly without like making a lot of faces at each other.
Well, that's just a couple of people. You know, the majority of the city council is actually pretty decent and civil. It's just a couple of people who sort of act out and cause most of the stress, and that's my interpretation of it. And I think I'm pretty careful never to curse at anybody, never to call anybody names, and never to make the kind of faces that they make when I'm talking. So sometimes it's hard because you want to say something because you're frustrated at how they're, you know, being abusive, but I'm generally able to restrain myself.
It was S shocking how there was no discussion went on this one issue, but you really could have said it about anything. When the sub said, "So should we talk about this before we vote?" No. And it was just like there were so many aspects that could have been discussed, and everyone, you know, like, then a youch.
Well, some people have their minds made up, and they don't want to be bothered with the facts and the complexities. It's you know, these issues are legally are relatively complicated, and you know what is constitutional and what's not, you know, requires you know significant amount of understanding. I mean, the sad reality of political life is the Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution, as I said at the council meeting, if they were to be voted on today by most legislative bodies in existence, they would be rejected. And you know, and yet, thankfully, the Bill of Rights is enshrined as a central part of our government, and so it protects people, you know, free speech, free press, all of these things. And these things have repeatedly been under attack in Berkeley. It's not just, you know, free speech on BTV. There was a proposal to force every newspaper in Berkeley to buy, to rent space in news racks from one anti-abortion company, which was a ridiculous restraint on the free press. And yet this was, you know, publicly proposed at a council meeting by, you know, the mayor, and heavily promoted and campaigned for. And luckily, in that case, the majority of the city council came to its senses and rejected it. But the fact that, you know, there are, you know, a significant number of politicians in Berkeley who would restrain the free press, who also, the majority of the council before I was there, voted to restrict homeless people in pretty severe ways, which were later ruled by the Ninth Circuit judge to be unconstitutional and thrown out. So, you know, there are attacks on, you know, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution multiple times in Berkeley. This is just one example. It's one, you know, that is pretty outrageous and pretty severe, because when they're attacking the homeless people, you know, it's sort of a pretty small group, but attacking the right of anybody at all, and I'm against attacking the homeless people and restricting their rights as well, but this is really an attack on thousands and thousands of people's right to watch things on cable TV, which is the only real alternative to commercial TV.
And that is what PU public TV is for. That is what public TV stands for. Yes.
Yeah, it should. And one of the ironies is, you know, if these regulations go into effect in Berkeley, Berkeley would have perhaps certainly amongst the 1% most restrictive standards of countries throughout the entire United States. And from
it, my, and it, oh, opens up the floodgates for cities all over the country.
Yeah, certainly. If Berkeley, with its progressive free speech traditions, is going to adopt one of the most regressive regulations of public access television, once we do that, you know, what's going to stop all of the more conservative places from saying, oh, well, if Berkeley's going to restrict it this much, why don't we restrict it even more? And that's perhaps the most scary part, is that Berkeley is so much in the forefront of setting legal trends. This is the worst kind of legal trend for us to be setting and empowering the far right wing to restrict free speech all over the country.
It gives the city, the remote remote control. S. So if that they don't like something, off it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite, you know, given the nature of politics, you know, it's whether they're left wing or right wing, or moderates or progressives, I mean, whatever their political ideology, do we really want city councils around the country to be actively involved in determining what the people who live in those cities are allowed to see? I mean, the general consensus around the country seems to be that if it's after 10 o'clock, you know, it's sort of out of the time when children you know, sort of most people would not then have to watch something they want to avoid. And that's...
What? That is what the...
FCC
has suggested.
Right.
So, if every other city, if every other channel is following that, that means all that somebody would have to do is flip a channel from BTV after 10 o'clock and they could find the stuff.
Well, sure. I mean, even if you just switch to Showtime or HBO,
right,
you can find a lot of things.
But what was that we were saying? Even if, like, okay, so if, say, people don't have any of those pay channels, we would just had our basic cable on the other night, and I think it was the Public Broadcasting Channel was doing, Channel 9 was doing a piece on this artist. And the images were really, really, like, violent, sexual, just, and they were huge. They filled the whole wall. Blood and sex. And it was like 10:30. It was 10:30. They were G R. They were great. I mean, we loved them. Right, we loved them. But because we're going through all this, we were saying, okay, now here's, if somebody is saying, I don't have pay channels, so my kids aren't going to come across Showtime. Well, this is just basic cable. You have to have basic cable to watch BTV. Mm-hmm. So you flip over to Channel 9, and at 10:30 you could have that. How does the midnight PR protect kids against the other channels? Protect kids? How does moving things to midnight protect kids if the other channels have stuff after 10 p.m.?
I don't have an answer to that question.
That's the kind of thing, that's what blows our mind. That why wasn't that, like, talked about? That seems like just, like, fundamental discussion 101 to just talk about things like that.
I don't think this really has to do with kids. I think children are being used as pawns as an excuse, like, oh, we have to protect our children.
Right.
For people who are offended by art, who are offended by culture and music and videos and films.
That was
readily apparent.
What I S A said to the BCM board when they first moved the stuff to 2 a.m., there was that short period.
Right.
And we got wind of that. We went to the board meeting. Mm-hmm. That's where the place was filled with people against the censorship, with one guy supporting it.
Well, we need to do that again when it comes back to the city council.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of people in Berkeley.
Everybody we run into... What can I do? You know, this is horrendous. We haven't met anybody on the streets, and we have people out there talking. If you need to talk to BCM. Who is? Chris needs to talk to BCM. Oh, they think that it's not their, that it's not cool for them to have an opinion.
Well, I mean, I'm sure to some extent, since the city has a control over funding to the Berkeley Community Media, they're not going to want to go and say, oh, you city council members are horrible, you're doing despicable, un-American and unpatriotic things and restricting our liberties. And then the city council could totally cut off their money and get rid of them, and, you know, so...
They think they have to be neutral. Like, they're saying... Maybe that's not what they mean is what you're saying, but what they're saying...
I think there's a fear factor, and that's part of what's wrong about government regulation of free speech.
Right.
Is there should you shouldn't have to be afraid that because you allow art and culture and films and videos, you shouldn't have to worry that the government's going to repress you because of, you know, the free speech that you're participating in.
F.
But it's financial reality.
FR.
Money. Money talks.
Free speech. Don't. E. X
exist
when that F fear is there.
Well, it's harder, but some people are brave enough to stand up to it, like you are. And well, I think in Berkeley, the majority opinion of the average people in Berkeley is, you know, we don't need to have Berkeley having stricter regulations than most of the United States in this area. I don't think it's something that, you know, 10,000 people are going to get out of their chairs and go have a big protest about, but I think it's something that the majority of Berkeley disagrees with having extremely strict regulations. And hopefully some of them will actually show up and write letters and email the city council and call them and give them a short course
emails?
Of education on what the Bill of Rights and Constitution are about.
Have you been getting a lot of calls and emails?
We've gotten very little calls either for or against. There's been a few more against, against having this kind of regulation, but you know, it hasn't been a deluge of a large number of people. You know, it's like about a dozen, I'd say.
Wow.
And you know, in order to get the city council's attention, you've got to get like 100 or 200 people to really take, because getting people to take the time to write a letter or send an email, you know, it takes a lot of organizing.
Right.
So they figure if they've got hundreds of people, you know, contacting them and calling them up, maybe it's something that people really care about and they should think about it. But sometimes even when a lot of people write to them, they still do the wrong thing anyway. So, you know, it's not a sure bet, but it can be an effective tool. And I think we have to try that because, it would be very sad and embarrassing for Berkeley to have such extreme restrictions.
I am S E setting up. Frank is setting up an anti-censorship benefit at Ashkenaz.
Oh, good.
And right now, it looks like it's going to be the end of July, the last Sunday in July. Mm. Will U S P, will you speak at it?
I probably can. I mean, it depends on the exact day and hour as to whether I'm committed to something else. But I'm sure we can work something out for time-wise.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think that would be extremely useful. And it might be that that's the week of the vote. Because if they really rush to ram it through the council before the summer break, you know, it could be that the last week of July is when the second reading is occurring. It would be extraordinary for the city attorney's office to do something that fast. So hopefully they won't drop the many far more important things that they're doing in order to ram this through. But, you know, with politics, you can never be sure.
Do you get a warning, or do you find out, like, the day before the council meeting what's going to happen?
We get the agendas the Thursday before the Tuesday meeting. So we get about 5 days advance notice, you know, that we're required to get by law, basically. Sometimes we find out ahead of time, but, you know, not necessarily. But as soon as we find out, we'll be sure to let you know, so you have a little bit of time to let people know.
The last one, you heard that. We just found out because the Daily Planet called us on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about what's going to happen at City Council tomorrow night?
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would have never found out. And we had even called Brian Scott after we talked to you about the Tom Bates thing, and you had said that there's going to be something coming up. So we called him right away.
Mm-hmm.
We said, you had said this. Does he know anything about it? Oh, no. You know.
Yeah, well, the council members who are promoting this probably didn't want people to know about
it
ahead
of time. That's what it seemed like.
Because then people would show up and oppose it.
Yeah.
So they just slipped it out there, you know, and to push it through. And then they changed the order of the agenda in order to move it up and, you know, ignore all of these more pressing issues that were on the agenda in order to make absolutely sure that it got done immediately rather than in its normal time frame after we dealt with about 20 other things that were ahead of it on the list.
I wondered about that. So there's like 20 things on that list. Is it the thinking when you go into that meeting that you're really going to deal with all those 20 things?
Well, if the council members are hot and bothered about something, then, you know, the order of the list can change. But, you know, many of the things that are on that list are very important issues, like dealing with the city response to hate crimes. You know, that's far more serious, and it's a very intense thing that the city should have a coordinated, comprehensive response to the anti-Latino, anti-Asian, anti-Jewish, anti-gay, anti-black. I mean, we've had hate crimes up the wazoo this year, and instead of dealing with our response to that and supporting the people in our community who are getting harassed, threatened, you know, they would rather harass and threaten a whole bunch more people by restricting free speech here. And, you know, the priorities just are not in sync with the people of Berkeley in that kind of activity.
S E sex is G L A glamorous. Even when it is not even sex. So you're saying it's more glamorous to bring that up than hate crimes? Is that what you're saying? There's a certain glamour to sex, even if it's not really sex. Like when what we are doing and now is seven, five, 75%. Mm. What we're doing now, meaning this conversation, is 75% of Frank's show on BTV. It's 2.5 hours. 75% of the time, it's people, this interview process. Emma, you, music. Then there's music part of the time. If we have a musical guest, they'll perform for 40 minutes or something. Then there is the A archives, A-R-T, the art that we, you mean like if we show somebody's video, so like a performance piece or something like that. That's a small percentage. Mm-hmm. And my P, my performances. I and that is what they are C-A calling sexually explicit. The percentage of the show that is Frank's performance footage is what is being called sexually explicit. Mm-hmm. I'm figuring they're not calling the interview part sexually explicit.
You never know.
Yeah, but so it's a small percentage and they're calling it sexually explicit, right?
Well, they would, I mean, I think for some of them, just the fact that we express these opinions are probably pornographic and objectionable in their point of view, that you would even talk about sex and say that sex is beautiful and, you know, that it's it should be, you know, it shouldn't be exiled into this sort of Netherlands where, you know, part of the repression of sexuality is what ends up, you know, in I think leading to rape, leading to, you know, people are so repressed about it that it leads to negative behavior. And if people would embrace our sexuality and accept ourselves and get over our prejudices against, you know, I don't like who you have sex with or what particular act you do. If people were educated and, you know, like sex education for kids has been one of the, a very effective program in many, many schools, including in the Berkeley schools. And those kinds of educational endeavors, you know, would, you know, the attitudes of the people on our council, some of them would not want that kind of educational material even to be shown, you know, during times when people who need it would be able to see it. That's tragedy.
On my show, things are not F R A G fragmented. I think that is one
reason
that people have a hard time. All why they are freaking out. How do you mean that they're not fragmented? They we T H throw everything in. Okay, all the various aspects of life are just thrown into the pot for any given show, rather than this is a show about this, this is a show about that. And so making everything one big ball of wax makes people uncomfortable. Yeah.
Well, there's so many levels of how people are repressed and afraid of sexuality. There are there are certain people who think that anyone who's disabled, and especially somebody who's in a wheelchair, should, you know, can't be having sex. Mm. And they're still set in these ideas from ancient times, you know, that disabled people don't have sex lives, and, you know, they're too crippled to, you know, to enjoy it or to provide pleasure to someone else. And that's obviously not true, as lots of disabled people in Berkeley can testify.
F. U. Funny. The. O. N. The only. C. O. M. P. Complaint. I. Had. S. E. E. C. Seen. The only complaint I've seen. The one article that was sent to us. Here it is. Is that the one you're talking about? Yeah. He. C. O. P. M. Complained about my F. L. O. Flopping around. Yes. All right. Let me find that line. This was a letter that was forwarded to us by somebody on the Berkeley the BCM board. Just to give us an idea of the kind of complaints they were getting. Frank Moore's show is just as bad. Nude women playing with themselves. Nude women pulling a nude Frank Moore out of his wheelchair, having sex with him, while he uncontrollably flops around drooling on himself. It looks like a sex party on LSD. It's not pretty.
Well, perhaps they're jealous that he has a better sex life than they do, and that's, you know, that might be true for a lot of people. But one of the reasons why so many people have bad sex lives is we're so repressive about allowing people to talk about it and learn about it.
Yes.
And so they're lonely and separated from other people, and if they, you know, if at an early age you learn about sex and what it's, you know, how it works and good human relation skills, then you're going to be less lonely and less frightened and, you know, be a healthier, fuller life. So.
Yes. At B. C. At BCM. They. S. They said. H. A. L. Half. Of. Half of Berkeley. H. I. Oh, half of Berkeley High watches Susan Block show.
No, I think young people need sex education. And so many parents are afraid to talk to their kids, and we have a whole bunch of kids who are having children while they're, 15, 16, 17 years old. And part of it is we haven't done education about sex and birth control. And it's vital that teenagers, I mean, no matter how right-wing and Republican you might be, it's just a practical benefit if we educate people so that there are less, kids born to people who are kids. And it's just so vital that teenagers get information. And it would be healthier for them to watch it on Berkeley Community Media and learn about it, and especially to watch it with their parents. If their parents can't talk about it, maybe they should actually sit down and watch shows with their kids.
Yes.
And maybe they'd both learn.
Yes. We. T. H thought when they said half of Berkeley High was watching Susie's show, we thought, wow, this is a public service, you know, that it really, you know, it seemed like a really good thing to have kids in high school age exposed to the Susie's attitude of about the body. It's so healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know the specific show, but certainly, you know, I think it's critical that teenagers get sex education and learn that sex isn't some secret thing that you just sort of you do, you know, sort of secretly and hide it from everybody and be embarrassed and scared. And that kind of attitude towards sex is what leads to, you know, so many teenage pregnancies. And it's so hard to raise a kid when you're so young. And it's vital that we get information to people just for that, along with, you know, it just helps people lead healthier, fuller lives.
Is that they, Jay, you, they just
don't get it.
P, you, they just put A, M, A, T, V, MTV, M, what was it, M-A-T-V, M-A-T-V, oh, mature TV, oh, that's what, that's what normal television does, they put an M-A-T-V thing on it, if you want to warn parents, but I mean, I think the BTV thing, you know, is like, if it's on after 10 p.m., it's being... The producer has called it an adult content thing, so it seems like that's, you know, I mean, people should know that. So that's kind of like putting the MATV label on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, realistically, this isn't about kids.
Right.
I mean, kids are just being used. It's about, you know, the same forces in society that have repressed art and music and culture and creativity and sex, you know, for century after century, and nowadays,
the current,
you know,
incarnation.
the newest way to do it is to pretend that you're liberal and it doesn't, you know, it's not for me, it's for the children. But, you know, it's obvious the distaste that some of the council members expressed, their own personal revulsion at dealing with sex and understanding sex, and, you know, that, you know, I mean, it's just a part of reality of life that people have sex, and, you know, maybe you don't approve of it, but it's gonna happen.
That was why they keep G-A gay T-E A teachers out of the classroom.
Well, and I believe one of the council members at the meeting said I would keep it off altogether. I wouldn't just limit it to after midnight.
Old, Betty Old. She said that if... And Polly Armstrong, too.
I don't remember.
If I had my way, it wouldn't be there at all. And which one of them said in the paper that Betty Old said that she's willing to take BTV off the air altogether if that's what it takes to get rid of these shows?
Yeah, well, that displays a remarkable lack of appreciation for the phenomenal benefits that come to Berkeley from having community media. There is such a wide range of programs. There are people learning how to do video. There are people learning how to be, interviewing.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many people of so many kinds in Berkeley learning from Berkeley Community Media. And in order to be repressive about sex, we're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater and throw out all of these amazing skills that people are learning. I mean, Berkeley Community Media is a phenomenal resource, and there are hundreds of people in Berkeley who have learned valuable job skills, you know, how to be on TV, you know, appearing on TV, working behind the cameras. I mean, there are so many skills that so many people have learned. And to be willing to sacrifice that because of prejudice against, you know, wanting, you know, sexuality and wanting to repress it, that's, you know, very short-sighted.
A. L. Also, it. S. H. O. It shows. It is. C. E. Censorship. Not. S. C.
Rescheduling?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's it. I
like,
mean,
right. Like, I just was be bumped to 11 p.m. on the night that Frank's show airs at 10 p.m. just got bumped to 11 p.m. because of scheduling, because of the rent board going over on a regular basis. That is not censorship.
Yeah, that's rescheduling.
That's rescheduling.
That's,
right.
that's what
fine,
they're pretending,
you know?
They're doing.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the real thing.
Yeah.
Then, but
people, then when they see changed, are you talking about Susie? No, then when they changed C H A channel
from 25 to 78,
when they will, when they will see H change their S C schedule. Oh, about requesting? Right, because we know that at the point where you can request new times, which is, I think, pretty regular, that we just will request a 10 o'clock time slot. So it's like not a big deal. It's like it's something you can work with, because it really is just rescheduling. That is S-C scheduling.
Yeah.
That's just a scheduling issue.
Well, every attack on the Constitution and Bill of Rights that's happened that I know of when I've been in Berkeley, it's never admitted that, you know, we don't agree with the Constitution or we don't agree with the Bill of Rights. And it's not admitted we want to do censorship. It's always given another name. But
yes.
even when people are preventing books from being published,
even.
You know, they always have some excuse.
Right. And Frank always says, I've never met anybody who says they're censoring.
No.
Nobody ever says I'm censoring. Even H. Helms said he was P. protecting M. O. Moms. Now M. I.
Minors.
No. Minorities. Helms said he was protecting minorities.
Probably not too many minorities felt very protected by what he was doing.
Yeah.
But I would agree with him on one score, which is that I think it is a minority of people who, you know, are really need to have the security blanket that they can repress sexuality and keep it out of, you know, everybody's view. And, you know, I think, you know, in the United States today, I think there's a lot more people who, you know, have at least partially come to grips with accepting sex as a natural part of life. And, you know, it has many different manifestations for different people. And there's not just one position that, you know, it's not one size fits all for everybody. And that's okay. You know, and we don't have to all be exactly alike. We don't all even necessarily have to understand each other. So I don't understand why people like to do one thing and don't like to do another. I don't even understand why I like to do one thing and I don't like to do another thing. Or, you know,
your
why do life. I like, you know.
Like? Oh, like Frank said? What is it that you don't understand that you what you like to do and don't like to do? Give us an example.
Well, for instance, I like drinking Diet Coke. And
give us something better than that.
I don't like, you know, drinking coffee. You know, and like in Berkeley, everybody in the city of Berkeley drinks coffee. It's like a religion. So, you know, who knows why people have the taste that they have.
V-O-T, vote for F-A-I, fair trade.
Fair coffee.
Yeah.
You mean the initiative that they're circulating?
Yes.
Actually, I don't really agree with. Berkeley does buy when the city of Berkeley buys coffee, we buy fair trade coffee. But I actually am uncomfortable with restricting every single coffee shop in Berkeley having to buy from, you know, one or two companies in the world, and I.
How?
I know it's a well-meaning measure.
How about L A B label it? Oh, just having people label what kind of coffee they have, not requiring them to have fair trade coffee, but having them label they have.
I'm gung-ho for encouraging it, and in fact, there are a couple of places in Berkeley which sell fair trade coffee, and they actually sort of promote that fact because certain people...
Where is that? Which places?
Since I don't drink coffee, I don't remember. But I know I remembered my friends mentioning it to me who do drink coffee. I'm sorry, I don't remember. But I know the city of Berkeley buys fair trade coffee purposefully as a as a purchasing policy, and we've done some promotional things. We've gone to the League of the Mayor's Conference and promoted fair trade coffee there. And, you know, so it's a popular idea. I'm just hesitant to restrict people and say you have to drink this one or two choices of coffee and every other kind of coffee is going to get kicked out of the city of Berkeley, because coffee really is a religion in Berkeley for many people. You know, they like love their coffee, and it would create a better market for fair trade coffee, but it's a little bit too restrictive regulation at this point in time.
How do you know keep H-O hopeful?
How do I keep hopeful?
E-S especially when
you lose.
U S I sit on in there every week.
Well, the most of the time after a fuss and a fight, generally, the liberal to progressive point of view wins at a city council meeting. Frequently, it only wins by one vote. like spending $1 million a year on affordable housing, it only won by one vote. And so when you propose something and it's, you know, it's a change of $1 million in one vote and it wins by one vote and you're one of those votes, it feels really good, like, wow, that $1 million wouldn't have been going to affordable housing if there was one less person on our side. And so it actually, partly because it's so bitterly contested and some of the moderates are pretty mean in the way they argue and attack and call people names, it actually, you really feel like what you're doing is valuable. And more often than not, we win. I mean, this particular vote, we lost. But in your average week, the more liberal point of view tends to win most of the time. And that's part of why people are so bitter. Because if, you know, if they were winning every single week, then they wouldn't be bitter because they'd be happy and they'd be like, oh, we're running the city into the ground like we were a few years ago when they had a majority. They put $0 of general fund money into affordable housing and switched that kind of money instead of helping affordable housing and helping, you know, racial minorities with health care and, you know, the kinds of things that we're doing with the money. You know, they put it into things that they thought were more important. So, you know, it actually feels quite positive to be able to be there and to be a voice for, you know, average people who maybe don't give maximum campaign contributions to certain politicians, who, you know, certain developers and corporate executives, and then they get benefits that probably, you know, certainly hundreds of thousands and sometimes millions of dollars of benefits go to these corporate executives and developers who, you know, and they've given, you know, $250 from husband and wife to a city council member, and they get hundreds of thousands of dollars in return from the city giving them special favoritism. And when you're able to defeat those, like, there was one $3 million giveaway that to a private guy that we killed. And instead, that money went to affordable housing, to parks, to the neighborhood parking improvements, and to the train station at downtown, at West Berkeley Amtrak. Seeing $3 million, instead of going to a private parking garage for, you know, going into these different community benefits, you know, that's like a very exciting thing to see, wow, it's different because we were here. And if any one of the five of us wasn't there, those things wouldn't be happening. So every single one of us is really important to be there, and it really, and some people say, you know, their lives in politics, nobody ever expresses appreciation to them. I don't think, probably maybe a day goes by, but never does a week go by when people don't, like, come up to me, including people I've never met before in my life, and say, thank you so much for, you know, doing this, or thank you for working on Saving the Starving Artists project, or thank... I literally can't remember a week in my life since I was elected that people thank me for things, and sometimes they thank me for things I don't even remember I did them.
Like?
So, you know, it's got its emotional benefits.
Like me? That you feel like you have, Frank feels like that. Then he gets a lot of positive feedback about what he does. That's a rewarding thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. F. You. Funny. I. Don't. G. O. Go. D. Downtown very often. Yeah. And he was speaking at UC Berkeley a couple of weeks ago, and so we were there like an hour and a half, 2 hours, and people were coming up to him all over the place saying, I love your show on cable.
Okay.
And, wow, you know, it's like people are watching it, people like it. So that was fun. 2 M U. Too much talk. Yeah, so that was the criticism. Too much talk.
Well, perhaps tonight's show is going to be one of your lowest rated shows because it's, you know, all talk and no action. Oh, well.
At the city council meeting, one of Jen, who was one of the real passionate speakers about the UCB Palestinian arrestee thing, and on her way up to speak, she leaned over and whispered to Frank, "I love your show." What did she say? So that was pretty funny. Yeah.
Probably people on both sides of those disputes probably enjoy the show, I would suspect. You know, whatever their political opinions, you know, it's...
F-U-N, funny. Every, even after, the, D, E, the debate that was on BTV, the, P, R, pro, censorship. Oh, right. There was a, they had a debate on BTV where they had the pro-censorship and anti-censorship, and Susie Block flew up here to represent the anti-censorship.
Oh, wow.
And the woman that was pro-censorship, at the after the debate was over and we were all hanging out and talking to her, she said she loved Susie's show. And, yeah. It, T, U, turns out, turn, she said it turns her on. That's what she said. What?
Well, I guess maybe that's scary to some people, that they don't want to be turned on and or don't want to allow other people to be.
We have... A S I T a website for the BTV stuff, the, all the BTV stuff. Yes. Oh, you're telling aeroplay.com/
FMUP
/
cable TV
dot HTML. It has all the newspaper articles that have come out in all the months that this has been going on, the letters to the editors, everything's there, and actually even the video of the two shows that BTV played, 2 half-hour programs, the debate and then the informational one, they're on there as real video. So it's, you know, everything's there. F.
And you don't have to wait until after midnight to...
Right, 24 hours a day. F U. R E A really S U Susie is A H A L half hour S so M O M I D midnight will not see cut out most of her audience because people would only have to stay up till 12:30 every even K even kids. But my Frank show is 2.5 hours, so it's a big difference.
Wow.
That means people have to stay up till 2:30 to see the whole show if it starts at midnight. Whereas when it starts at 10 p.m., most people can stay up till 12:30 to watch the whole thing. J Jay? You? Just one of the FAC facts? S, what, just one of the facts? That they didn't discuss at the city council meeting.
Don't confuse me with the facts. They might get in the way.
Is there any discussion among council members not during the meeting? Like, do people kind of get together in the hallways or in rooms and talk about things informally?
Sometimes. Well, there's one council member who refuses to even say hello to me when I walk by her, so there's not an awful lot of conversation with her, but some of the council members are friendly to each other and talk to each other, and but, you know, I think on this particular issue, I don't think they really wanted to hear very much of the facts. And it's almost just like some of them are afraid of the shows. They're actually afraid of talking about the shows. And, you know, so there's that phobia even in the nature of, you know, what they're allowed to talk about themselves. And, you know, that's hard to get around.
Like what? No, like, is that what you're saying?
Like who?
Like who? No, like what? Like, what are they afraid to talk about? What phobias? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, I think that's it.
Well, I think that sometimes the city council talks and talks about a subject and they keep repeating the same things over and over again, but it doesn't really get into the substance. And, you know, in a way it's a charade, because it's about, somebody has their soundbite that they want to get out there, and they just keep harping on their message and their soundbite, and it's not a real discussion or dialogue. It's more, I've got to hit my point home, and it's not like, okay, I'm going to listen to the other council member and think about what they're saying and balance it. In that way, the city council is not that much different than most elected bodies.
That's what I was wondering. Is that just typical? That's just the way it is.
Since I was elected, I've learned so much about government that would make most people far more cynical and disgusted with government than they already are. Like, for instance, we get this giant packet of information, and I spend hours and hours every week reading through all of these tons of things. And what I've learned in every agency that I served on is that most members of most legislative bodies don't even read the information that they're given before the meeting. They skim it, or they read the headlines, but they don't actually read their packet. And when I read through it and I point out, well, on page, 27, it says, this, people are like, oh, really? I don't know. And
like,
so it's sort of funny that government can be so, elected officials can be so cavalier about not really getting into the details of the things that they're voting on. And they just vote the way their staff tell them to vote. And if somebody raises questions, it's like, oh, that's odd or unusual. Like, you're not supposed to think about these things. You're just supposed to show up and sit there and vote and then shut up and, go home. And luckily, in Berkeley, and in the Bay Area, we've got a lot more people who do read these things, and people in the public who read the council packet and find the controversial things and speak up and point things out. And we're lucky that we have so many, really, really hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who do that and who become advocates for all kinds of, neighborhood issues and citywide issues and human rights issues. You know, there's such a range of
life.
People.
When I R E read the P A packet A about this I S A I saw the C O U R the court the courts S A the courts say L A W laws that P R O protect kids have to be A S as L E A S least S T R I strict I restrictive as possible
Yeah. Well, like that would seem to suggest that our city council doesn't need to do anything on this subject.
Yes.
But nobody on our city council is a lawyer, and you know nobody has a maximum education about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and probably few, if any, have maximum education about sex and sex education and the possible positive benefits of people learning about it through art and video.
C I and the city attorney is the one who gets who F O U found A W A away to get A around the R I G the right to A J U R jury.
Oh yeah, that was one of their more clever things, that because juries in Berkeley refused to convict people
for the nude
theater group, the explicit players that performs, the juries kept not finding them guilty, so they took away the right to a trial by jury in those kinds of cases by changing it into a
misdemeanor.
A misdemeanor, and that puts it in the hands of a judge instead of a jury. So it's a very clever way to take away people's rights, because they know that most juries in Berkeley are, you know, it's not likely to convict people, just like who's going to convict people for having these TV shows. So they find technical legalities of how to restrict people's rights, and most people haven't the foggiest idea this is going on. You know, if you put this on the ballot, do you want to take away the right to a trial by jury to the explicit players theater group who do nude live performances? it's not going to win, but they find a technicality of how they can restrict the right, and they get away with it. And, you know, there's repression isn't just somebody standing over you, you know, with a gun or a hammer beating you over the head. You know, it has many less overtly ugly manifestations.
Most times, it's not that at all.
Yeah,
most times, it's the sneakier ways.
In the United States, yes, I think that tends to be the case. People sort of cloak their repression with, this is good for you, or, you know, this is, you know, for the good of the children, and instead of, you know, really admitting how repressive they're being. But ultimately, you know, it's still better to be fighting those battles and sometimes have a chance to win, thanks to, you know, the courts, than it is to live in a society where people just shoot you because they don't like what you're doing. And, you know, so it's, there are relative trade-offs, and, you know, the United States does have, you know, a lot of legal protections, thankfully.
Any?
For which I'm very grateful to live here.
Any W? O? Word? From ACLU? Have you gotten any word from them?
I've spoken with the ACLU a few times about this issue, and they have assigned a woman attorney and an intern to sort of do the preliminary legwork of researching, you know, what cases are out there and what, you know, whether or not this is something that's worth challenging. They can't take every single case that they agree with because they have very limited staff time. And so usually a group like that, just like the NAACP or MALDEF, don't help every single person that's discriminated against. They help people who have a test case that if they win, you know, if they have good facts and good evidence that they have a good chance to win, that it can set a precedent for other cities or other people. And the ACLU sort of works the same way. They don't take everyone who should win, they can't possibly help all those people.
Right.
And so they have to pick and choose. I don't know if they'll determine that this case is sufficiently significant and that the facts of the case are the strongest likelihood. And, you know, there's a mixed bag about, you know, how people feel about individual cases. And as a lawyer, you want the best facts of, you know, like procedural irregularities or mistakes that were made by somebody in their preparations. And the most severe damage and restrictions, so that, you know, you have the best chance of people saying, oh, that's too extreme. So, you know, they've got to do a lot of research to see if this is a model case or test case that could establish precedents. Certainly having a case in the Ninth Circuit Court, which is perceived to be one of the more liberal in the United States, you know, there's going to be a better chance in the Ninth Circuit than there is in some more reactionary courts. Although the way the courts are getting packed these days with, you know, what's his name, Smith is now up for approval with, you know, really outrageous anti-disabled policies. You know, there's more and more judges being appointed who are more and more reactionary, and, you know, that's really hurting the judiciary seriously. And it's probably going to keep happening for the next few years, at least as long as we, you know, with the current political situation.
And then they will STA start, stay on the BE bench.
Many judges are lifetime appointments, so Once they get on there, then you have to deal with them for a long time. You know, but there's also some very good judges, and in the Ninth Circuit Court, we've had some, you know, pretty good cases. I mean, they're the people who ruled that the Berkeley's unconstitutional restrictions on the homeless were too severe. So, you know, Berkeley has already been, you know, has lost many cases in the courts. Most of them were lost because Berkeley tried to do progressive things, and the more conservative judges wiped out what Berkeley tried to do, like commercial rent control, which was trying to help small business people. And it got wiped out because they said you can't restrict commercial rents. But you know, a few times there's been cases like the anti-homeless laws that were ruled invalid. So you know, it's possible. It's not a sure thing, and in part it depends on the exact details of what the city council votes for. You know, on the face of it, it seems dubious to me. And you know, I'm sure they're going to do everything they can to make sure that every single word is, you know, written to try to, you know, to be as repressive as possible and still make it through the courts.
What is S E sexually explicit?
Well, that's a funny thing, because some people think sex only has to do with certain organs, and in reality every single inch of your body can be part of sexual expression. And you know, kissing is one of the most, for me, kissing is probably the most intense sexual component of relating to somebody, and it's, and yet, you know, it's like people, when people are kissing, it's like, what's the big deal?
I just T-O touched your leg. Is that sexually explicit?
Well, I guess you can't show this program at the long hour of the day. And it's actually possible, and you know, for two people to achieve orgasm without just from looking at each other and never touching each other.
Yes.
So is that not sexual just because you're not touching? I mean, the whole barriers and definitions of what is sexuality are very limiting.
And Z I Z I L O Z I L O Zilo T V. Oh, that's a show on BTV that's on before 10 o'clock. Is that right? Yeah. They, it is for C O College S T students and one of their things is offering people money to do something. T A take off their clothes, or piss in their pants. This is like the show. This is on before. This is like an afternoon program. So these guys go around with their camera and they say, "I'll give you $20 if you'll take your clothes off." And then they find somebody who'll do it. See, of course, they B L O block. Oh, they do that black bar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's like okay. That's the question of what is sexually explicit. Like the, apparently that's not. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it is. But lots of other things should be too.
Yeah. To at or B A back S T A stage backstage is A M U music show about A I aimed to B L black kids. Oh, the they have these kind of commercials.
Risky
about
commercials.
Well, no, about joining the military. And it's a show that's clearly aimed at black kids, and they have all these ads to join the army. And that runs during the day on BTV. They get away with that. B E because it is P S A. P.S. Oh, it's a public service announcement, right?
Yeah. Well, if you're part of the military establishment, then it's okay. Probably if they were doing, you know, somewhat risque advertisement for that, then probably that would be okay, too. It's, you know, I guess I would be cautious to talk about, you know, the college student show or any other instance of things, because then it might give the wrong people the idea that they should go after more shows and try to restrict them. Last thing we need is to give them any new ideas of what to repress.
Is the D A that is the danger of this whole thing, that once you start...
Yeah, this week it's Frank Moore, and next week it's, you know, who knows what's next.
Right.
And it's, you know, once there's momentum built to restrict free speech, it's, you know, even in the conversation about this, some of the council members were talking about, well, violence is worse than sex, so why outlaw sex but not outlaw violence?
Right.
And
right.
I understand their point, and I agree that violence is worse than sex, but we certainly don't even want to think about trying to outlaw violence or sex.
It's so fuzzy.
Sex. And, you know, it's scary how many things could be outlawed.
Yes.
And you have not the city council not just censoring, you know, allegedly sexually explicit material, but... You know, you go down all kinds of roads of censoring political content and artistic content of many kinds.
R-A-P, rap, censoring rap music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people are certainly, there's a lot of pressure to do that. And to some extent, there's a self-censorship that, you know, the media... doesn't, you know, they sort of censor things that they think might offend people, even though there's not an absolute law that they have to.
That.
So there's already a kind of censorship out there as it is.
Y P U public access is so important.
Yeah. Well, that's fundamentally, what's so scary about all this is that right here in Berkeley, right on public access TV, the city council, elected by the people of Berkeley, could be trying to be so restrictive. That is so absurd, so extreme.
Like, if you want, don't, if you don't like my show,
don't watch it.
Don't watch it. Do your
own show.
Do your own show, right?
Yeah.
What? Get it on before my show?
Yeah, that would be great. The people who are so into repressing sex can have a nice, prim, and proper show and have them give lectures about why people shouldn't watch
this show. Yeah.
And they can give everybody... and see which show gets more people watching it.
That is free speech.
Yes, the competition of the marketplace of ideas.
But they are afraid.
No, it's also, you know, to compete with, you know, to put a competing show would require, you know, some intellectual discipline and some hard work, and, you know, it's especially to do it on a regular basis. I mean, it takes a lot of dedication for somebody to learn all these things about media and how to put it all together. And there are so many different features of it. Just the fact that on Berkeley Community Media, people can see, I mean, I've actually see this board and see somebody speaking from this board.
Right.
There is so much education going on just by people getting used to the idea that someone can communicate with a board like this.
Yes.
And that is so exciting to, you know, that's happening.
I am you. P up A G up against L E T Letterman and Jay Leno. When you watch that TV guide thing that's on cable, you see David Letterman, Jay Leno, Frank Moore. We always enjoy that.
Well, at least your real competition has been moved. Judge Judy, wasn't her showtime changed?
Oh.
So now your real competition is, you know, you've scared her away. They moved her time to something, I forget.
I and B and 4 H O U hours and 4 hours. Oh, that your show is on for hours. Yes. D, S. So.
Daily.
Is not S. O. Sound bites. Yeah, that's the other the way. Like when Frank wanted to have a 2.5 hour program, because that's like busting open another frame, where, you know, you have a half hour interview. So many people that come on the show, they can't believe that they can really just sit here and talk for 2 hours. You're not gonna have a music break? No. K. E. Kevin Danaher. He was a guest.
Global Exchange?
Yes, he was a guest recently, and it took us about a year to schedule it with him. And we finally set it up, and he calls us like 2 hours before he's supposed to come over, and he says, "Now, Frank, how long is this show?" Frank said, "It's a 2 hour interview." He said, "Oh, no, I can't make it. You know, I have my babysitter, my kid, da da da." And, you know, we had told him, like, for a year that it was a two-hour show, so we knew it was a two-hour show. He's trying to get out of it. So he goes, well, look, you know, I can come over and we can do, like, a 45 minutes, an hour show. You know, it's like we're taking this year to schedule this. You want to just do that? Frank said, no, I think I want the 2 hours. We'll reschedule it one more time. And so then it was like he had to say okay, you know. So and then, sure enough, we reschedule it, and he comes, and the show, like 2.5 hours later, we're still talking, and Frank says at that point, and you thought we couldn't fill 2 hours. And he said, I'm so used to being on the shows where you have to talk fast and it's short, and, you know, it's just like busting open another frame to just kind of hang out for 2 hours and feel like you can really talk about something.
Well, when you go on, I mean, most of the times when I'm on TV, it's like two sentences. And then you're lucky. Oh, well, it wasn't one sentence, it was two sentences. So if you get, you know, if you get 30 seconds, you know, or a whole minute, that's a lot.
So that's like the way we look at this show. It's that's another element of it that we've feel is subversive, is we're subverting the whole kind of idea that things have to be short and people can't talk in depth about something. And it's just like, you know, they tune in and we're still there 2 hours later talking about something. But they can not you turn they can't turn it off because when's the nudity going to change? That's not it. They can't. Oh, the people find that they say they can't turn it off. Is that what you mean? Because they're into it. Is that what you mean? B. E. Because they n never know what's going to be next. When. The nudity is going to be there? Right, exactly. Because Frank will throw it in, you know.
Right. You like, never know.
You never know. That's what it says. You never know what you're going to fall into. That's the opening thing.
Yeah, that was funny. Because when you were at the city council meeting, you mentioned something about having Chris Worthington on the show, and some people would think that
that's
pornographic.
Offensive
or something.
Yeah.
So several people came up to me and said, oh, when did you do a pornographic show? I'd really like to get a copy of the videotape.
That's cute.
Sorry.
B, obviously, they don't have, they don't watch my show.
Well, at least not every week, I guess, but.
Yeah, it's been 2 hours. It goes fast.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's 11:15, so it's been close to 2 hours.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
An hour 45.
Oh, it's been an hour and 45 minutes.
Wow.
Right, we started at 9:30. Oh, because you have the tape going. Yeah, an hour 45. Yeah.
Well, are there other subjects that you want to talk about, or things that,
why are the why are the food, those little portable food things? We just read a thing in the paper that there's something about that. And the article in the paper, we couldn't make any sense about it.
Yeah, it was a very confusing
bad article.
Story.
Yeah.
The last couple of decades, you could establish a food cart in the city of Berkeley. Most of them have been at Telegraph and Bancroft. And you could set them up, and, you know, it's sort of a good way to get an entry into starting a business, a small business. And then some of them have actually grown into storefronts that became successful establishments. And some of them have stayed as on-the-street food vendors. And recently, in trying to standardize this and get it more organized, the city spent like over a year doing all this research to make sure that everything's going to be done right. And now at the last minute, as a surprise, the moderates added an amendment that wiped out any chance of having food carts anywhere in the city of Berkeley except on Bancroft and Telegraph, on those two streets. And up until now, it's always been legal pretty much in any commercial district, when, as long as the city does the research and makes sure that you have enough feet to fit it, and as long as you meet the health and safety requirements and codes and inspections. But suddenly, we've been talking about this for over a year, suddenly at the last minute, when the motion was on the floor with no notice, they added a surprise amendment that says you can't do this anywhere else in Berkeley, even though you've been able to do it for the last 30 years. And I was pretty shocked that they would just spring that as a big surprise and restrict it so much, especially because now the university is threatening to end the food carts there on their property, and it could end up that what the city council is voting on could mean that it would be illegal to have food carts anywhere in Berkeley. That's not the stated goal of the moderates who proposed this. They said, oh, we like the food carts, we just, right, you know, we want to do these regulations. But they've been permitted for decades, and suddenly they're saying you can't do it anywhere else, you can only do it on this street. And that is the one street where the university is potentially going to eliminate it. So the net effect could be that we have a law that you can't have any food cart anywhere in Berkeley, basically.
So that has to be voted on? That's,
yeah, it's coming up for us, a vote next Tuesday. But we lost that one by one vote. The amazing thing about Berkeley politics that most people don't understand, they think, oh, Berkeley's so progressive, and like everybody on the city council must be progressive. But most of the most interesting and progressive things that we've ever done win by a very tiny margin, like one vote frequently. And it's sort of amazing that it could be that close. And this one was another one where this one, instead of winning by one vote, we lost by one vote. And
so the
it's
part
an unintended
lost
consequence.
Already now?
The first vote we lost by one vote, and now it's coming back for the second vote. And they don't intend, it's not like they're maliciously scheming, like, how can we wipe out those food vendors? It's the unintended consequence of severely limiting it to this one little area, when for decades it's been allowed anywhere in the city in a commercial area. And they're just severely restricting it without any advance notice to anybody in the world that
they're
going to
do this.
And do
they say why they want it just in that one area?
Because we don't want to allow this to proliferate in other business districts around the city without notifying anybody. But it's like,
it's already there.
It's been legal around the whole city.
Like downtown Berkeley, it seems like there's a lot of vendors.
There have been, historically, you know, there have been some food vendors. But most of the time, in most parts of the city where people have tried it, there wasn't enough foot traffic, and so they couldn't make enough money by doing it. So that's why most of them tend to be on Telegraph, where you've got, Telegraph is the most successful business district in the city by far.
Yes.
There's $100 million in sales in a little four-block area close to campus, or five blocks.
So it would not SPR spread anyway if people can't make money in the other areas.
It might, we don't know. But to me, it's absurd. It's just another form of repression and restriction to take what has been allowed for 30 years and to restrict it so severely that you can only do it in this one little area. And they're ignoring the fact that it's been legal throughout the entire city for all these years. They're like, as if it's some new thing. I mean, they just don't understand that it's always been legal all over the city. If you have the right space requirements, you can't just do it in a narrow sidewalk. You have to have the right dimensions. So we're going to bring that back, and I'm sure that the vendors, when they see what's happened, will be very upset.
So this thing about two votes, is that the way it goes for anything? There's
any
a first vote and a second
has
vote?
Meetings.
And what happens between the two? What's the reason for the two votes?
Well, occasionally people hear about the first vote and then they convince somebody to change their mind and then something happens differently. Most of the time, whatever happens on the first vote, the second vote is exactly the same. I mean, that's the norm. But every once in a rare while, it can happen that people get more information or get convinced to change their mind. It has been known to happen, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a very sad vote. And we had no time to prepare any arguments against it because it was just sprung as a surprise, you know, late in the meeting. And if they had said anything ahead of time that they were going to try to restrict it in the whole city, we could certainly have brought lots of food vendors and other people to come and say, no, don't restrict it. But we had no advance notice.
So they don't have to have it on these papers you get on Thursday to warn you about
it? In theory, you're supposed to, you know, have things published ahead of time. But, you know, they're going to argue, well, this is just a minor change. The fact that we wipe out 99% of the places where they can be, that's just a minor change. And I'm not sure that there's any legal recourse against that. I mean, you can make amendments. It's just such a severe amendment that it's pretty absurd.
In reality, it is K-I-N kind of S E C secret? It's kind of secret? You mean this particular thing or generally?
Well, it was a surprise that they sprung this change.
You mean even generally? You mean any of the things that come in front of the city council? Well, it seems like you have to kind of go out of your way to find out what's going on. Like, it's not like, I mean, it seems like the information is available. Like, I saw you can go to the website and get it. But you have to kind of be hip to the way it works. And
right. I mean, your average person doesn't check every single Thursday and see, okay, there's 100 things on the agenda. I'm going to read every single one and see if one of them is restricting my rights this week.
And the other thing is the public. Comment section is not very encouraging. Like, I noticed not just with our thing, but with the other speakers too, except for East Bay Mud, most of the people on the council didn't seem that engaged. And it seemed like they weren't making an effort to appear engaged, even like on a surface. Like, in fact, it almost seemed like they were making an effort to appear not engaged. Except when East Bay Mud spoke, and then it seemed like everybody was just kind of like really into it. And so I don't know if it's like unconsciousness or if it's conscious, you know, but it seemed like it was set up not to make people feel encouraged to come and have a say. So not only is it secret, but even once you find out about it, it doesn't feel very like citizen friendly.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of improvements that are needed. It's been about a year and a half since we proposed a sunshine ordinance to make more information available to the public. And the city attorney, of course, is spending more time working on, you know, repressing Berkeley community media. And that time should be spent on the sunshine ordinance, which is a list of like 9 things to make information more available. There's also elements of secrecy where when the city council votes in executive session, the city attorney and the mayor choose not to report that out to the public unless they are absolutely required by law to do so. So there's 3 categories. There's one category where you have to report this out. There's another category where you can't report it out. And then there's an in-between category where if you want to, you can report it out, but you don't have to by law. So
who created those laws? These are the state categories.
Three categories. So the ones that we absolutely are legally required to report out, we do. The ones where we have discretion, we could either report it out or not, we don't. I argue if we're allowed to report it out, we should. why should we keep it secret from the public what happened in our executive session, what motions were made, what the votes were, because then there's no accountability to the public. If somebody made a motion and it got four votes and it lost by one vote, the fact that four people tried to do something good should be known to the public, and who the five people are who stopped them should be known to the public.
And is that something that you vote on?
The city attorney and the mayor decide not to report things out.
And they're the ones that have the say?
We've actually talked at one point to a lawyer about sort of doing a form of civil disobedience and taking information that they choose not to report out and making a splash with the media and say, we are reporting this out because there is no law that says we can't.
Mm-hmm.
And then challenging them to do something to punish somebody for telling the truth and providing this secret information that should be public to the public. But we haven't gotten around to doing that yet because there's so many battles on so many issues, on environmental issues and senior issues and housing issues and transportation issues. You know, it's
E N censorship. It's censorship. No, censorship. What about censorship? T A take time. Censorship takes time.
Yeah, every issue that we work on, it takes a certain amount of time, and organizing people, and you know, I have basically, I think a few months ago we actually added how many projects is my office currently working on. And we had 287 live, active projects of things that we're trying to do, you know, that we have either volunteers or interns or my staff person or myself working on. And just keeping track of all those different subjects, and, I mean, some of them are sort of amorphous, like trying to increase the diversity of the age of people on city commissions. Before I got elected, you could count on your fingers how many people under the age of 40 served in the approximately 400 spots on city commissions. That's absurd, where most of the population of Berkeley is under 40, a big majority. And so we have made small steps forward, and now we're, you know, we've probably tripled the number of people under the age of 40 in city government, you know, which is, and we've doubled the number of Asians and the number of Latinos. But what that means is instead of having 5 Asians, now we're up to 10.
Right.
But it's still pathetic that in a city where, like, nearly 20% of the population is Asian, that, you know, maybe 2% or 3% of the government, you know, is. It's, you know, there's severe underrepresentation of, you know, ethnic minorities, of the disabled community, of young people, and, you know, sort of, and even, you know, I mean, I don't know if people who are in their 30s are considered young anymore, but they're severely underrepresented too. And there are so many people who don't have representation and aren't allowed to participate equally by the nature of politics in Berkeley. And most people that come to Berkeley, they see this lively political culture and people working on national and international and all these big political issues, but they're somewhat separated from the government itself. And Berkeley's a very racially segregated city in many ways, and that, you know, so there's all these racial groups that have virtually no representation
at
all.
It is getting more
worse,
racially.
Yeah.
I mean, like our neighborhood, when we moved here, it was a real mixed street. And the houses, you know, I mean, like, we couldn't afford to buy a house on the street now.
Yeah.
That was why we wanted to live here, you know. Mm-hmm. We wanted to get away from our yuppie street that we had been renting a house on, And this was like a neighborhood, and there were families that had lived here, you know, for generations, and, you know, every kind of race and age group and everything. And slowly the people that have lived here are moving, and then when their house goes up for sale, it's like $500,000. Yeah. You know, so who's going to afford $500,000? Rich white people, you know, and that's so it's
well, not
it's
exclusively.
Changing.
We're losing the African Americans, and we're losing the middle class and the low income people. Mm-hmm. But in the people who are moving into Berkeley, there's still an increasing racial diversity of Asians and Latinos. Asians and Latinos are increasing. African Americans are being driven out, and low income people are being driven out, and so it's it's really important that we find ways to help people stay here.
H I, which is your B A S, which is your base. That's the group that's your base, the people that are being driven out, Frank said. Is that what you mean? Is that what you mean? His base or the people that are being driven out of Berkeley?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of artists, not only can they not afford to have a studio, but...
Oh, you're talking about when you're into... When Jelinek was running for mayor, what's his first name? Don Jelinek.
Uh-huh.
He ran against Shirley Dean.
Uh-huh.
And so he was a guest on Frank's show while he was running.
Oh.
And so he was, you know, the guy that we were supporting. And and so when Frank was talking about how the artists couldn't afford to live in Berkeley anymore, is that what you're, the aspect you were doing? He said, well, but they'll come to Berkeley to do their art, to present their art, and all the various things that we'll keep having. And Frank said, but they won't be voters anymore. And if you lose that aesthetic from the voting population, it's going to change Berkeley. And
well, and we shouldn't have to... I mean, it's bad enough that America exiles so many of its artists to Europe. We shouldn't exile our artists out of Berkeley. It should be possible to make, you know, to have a studio and or to have a, you know, a place to live in the city, which is such a mecca for so many arts and music and cultural, you know, events. You shouldn't have to commute to be an artist, to be a performer. That's disgusting.
He did not get that. He didn't get that will change Berkeley. That point that losing the voters will change. When you have, like you were saying, well, the whole 4th Street area is an important tax base for the city.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank said, but they're the voters now. You know, they're the people that are voting in Berkeley, whereas the artists are not voting in Berkeley, and that's going to change Berkeley.
Right.
D-E-A. Dean. O, P, E, people. They're all Shirley Dean people.
Well, certainly the people who are making the millions of dollars are her campaign contributors and supporters. But I think Tom Bates has a much, has a lot more experience and a lot more, you know, work with a lot of communities more than Don Jelinek has. And, you know, Don was, you know, a good man, and, you know, he had some very good ideas. But he didn't... His campaign was run by somebody from Sacramento who didn't really understand Berkeley. And I don't think Tom Bates is going to bring in some Sacramento consultant who doesn't understand the dynamics of Berkeley. You know, he's been elected for 24 years, and, you know, he's definitely fought for the liberal side. He's not, you know, he's not a radical, but he's certainly very liberal and somebody who can work with people. I mean, the biggest problem with Shirley Dean is not her ideology and her conservatism on certain issues. It's that she's so difficult. Even if you agree
absolutely
with her,
absolutely, that was obvious at the council meeting,
and that is a whole different dynamic.
It seems like it's really important to have somebody that is someone who communicates and who tries to create an environment of communication in a position.
Yeah. So even if we had somebody with her bad politics, it wouldn't be so bad if they were somebody who would be nice to people and work with people.
Right.
And I think Tom Bates has both of those features in that he has basically good politics and he's very easygoing and nice to people. Nobody could ever accuse him of being mean and, you know, sort of vindictive and vicious and all that kind of stuff. Nobody ever really gets that from him. So, you know, I think it's a very different dynamic than it was, you know, there.
U A M B ambitious politically, you mean? Are you politically ambitious? Is that what you mean? Yes.
Well, a lot of people asked me to run for mayor.
You're
when they didn't think Tom Bates was going to run.
I am. Your image is. That's the way you come across. Is that what you mean? That you do have ambitions. Is that, yeah. But when you I sit down, but when you're sitting here talking to you, you don't seem like that. You seem different than the way you come off as your image.
Well, I guess
here.
That's good. My role in life is sort of funny. I didn't really want to be an elected politician, and in fact, if you had told me a few months before I ran for city council that I was going to do it, I would tell you you were crazy.
What?
And I wouldn't.
Would you what would you have thought your role in life would have been?
Basically I've worked with a lot of nonprofit organizations. I started a shelter for homeless women. I ran a daycare center, a food co-op, a housing co-op, home for mentally retarded adults. And I've always sort of been a volunteer and eventually became manager or executive director of all these different nonprofit groups. And basically, when they were in a state of crisis or sort of growing pains, like they were starting to get bigger and they didn't know how to manage themselves, I would come in and create sort of a friendly bureaucracy of how to treat people well and yet get your paperwork done. And really, that was my role in life for decades, you know, until I ran for city council. And I've done that with a lot of nonprofits.
Why did you run for city council?
I had sort of lobbied our council member for many years about lack of appointing students and young people, not appointing, you know, people of diverse races. And then she didn't really respond to those things. And then when she started supporting landlords tearing down buildings and evicting disabled tenants and voting to give hundreds of thousands of dollars to developers who gave thousands of dollars to her campaign, it just got to be too many controversial things, especially on affordable housing. And so there were so many people mad at her, and they said, well, no, I said, nobody can beat her. She's got too much money, she's too famous, and, you know. And so finally, people were writing me letters and saying, you've got to run. And finally, one of them tried a new argument and said, well, of course you won't win. And but you can just spend a month, educate people about the issues and raise the issues, and then, you know, then you'll go back to living your normal life because you'll lose. And I said, oh, well, if it's only a month or two, I guess I can handle that. And did, I agreed to run, and then I won.
Did you? Did you S U E sue that person after you won?
No, it's sort of funny. I, in a way, I'm very grateful. Being on the city council, I've learned a lot. You know, there, you're dealing with 50 to 100 different issues every week, and it's sort of interesting to learn what are the environmental impacts about sweeping the streets and the sidewalks. Like, what are the environmental impacts of these little day-to-day things, and how can you move money around so that you help poor people and help, you know, people who need things, and how can you balance all these different things? I'm also actually in the process of learning how to give a speech. My first 4 years in elected office, maybe once a year I gave a speech where a lot of people interrupted me with applause. This year I've given dozens of speeches. Most of my speeches, it doesn't happen, but it's like maybe every other week or something, I give a speech and people really get into it and they interrupt you and they clap and then you have to stop and let them clap and then start again. And it's so much fun when you can feel, you just feel the audience is on your side and they're relating to what you're saying. That is such a fun, it like goes through your whole body, like, wow, I'm really connecting with some people.
That
it's a big thrill.
That is why I
do my show.
Why I am a performer.
Yeah.
To have that connection with with people. Yeah. Yeah. C R create. C, community, to create community.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, that's one part of, you know, the excitement. Also, coalition building is really exciting to me, to sort of, I in a normal day, I may go to like 10 or 12 different groups. And so, like, I spend half an hour here, an hour there, and an hour there, 2 hours there. And then networking them with each other and like, well, have you thought about working with this group, which is doing sort of a different part of the same issue, and trying to link people together and be sort of a conduit for coalition building. That is one of the most exciting things too, to sort of get people to see the commonalities of their experience and think, oh, well, we could help each other and do this together, and we'd both be better off.
A P U public S E R service V a public servant. That's being a public servant.
In a way, I guess. In a way, I thought I was more of a public servant before I got elected, because I would always volunteer to do anything under the sun to help somebody who had a problem or to help an individual person or a group. And now that I'm a city council member, it's sort of the same, but it's sort of different, because people are actually nicer to me now that I'm a city council member. And before, when I was just some kid or some person trying to help people, you know, a lot of people weren't very nice to me, you know, and now people, you know, like, oh, you're a city council member, I guess we won't beat you up and drag, you know, like, drag you down, you know.
I will beat you up. And
I'm all in favor of other people getting into S&M, but not me getting into S&M. I'm a little behind the times in that regard.
But I need you. So that's why you're not going to beat him up too bad, because you need him.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll vote for that. I'm a very non-violent person. I try not to beat anybody up, but with a few rare exceptions.
I am P R A C T
practicing.
He's a practical guy. He's not going to beat you up because you're on his side.
Yeah. Yes, I like to think of myself as a practical idealist, where I have lots of idealistic ideas, but like when I'm writing my city council items, I try to think, what is likely to get 5 people to vote for it? So how can I word it in a way that it will win? Or like, how can I ask for enough to make a difference, but not so much that it's, you know, nobody's going to vote for it.
Right.
And, you know, it's sort of an interesting challenge of how to keep your idealism when you're in government itself and you have to deal with, you know, budgets and staff resources and, you know, opposition and all those kinds of things. It's an interesting challenge to how to be practical and still be a progressive and idealistic person.
Idealistic is P is practical. C Y cynical ain't practical.
Well, yeah, it's sort of funny. A lot of times the idealistic thing of doing prevention, you know, sort of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And a lot of things that we do in terms of especially health programs trying to do prevention, really the idealistic prevention thing really works. And, you know, if we could do more of that kind of stuff, we could save billions of dollars in healthcare costs from preventing people from getting sick in the first place and preventing corporations from polluting the air and the water and getting people sick from all the things they do. That, you know, that would be very practical in terms of healthcare costs to society. But, you know, the power of money in politics is very overwhelming. Even in local Berkeley politics, you know, the money is a, you know, you can only give $250. So you would think, oh, well, nobody's going to sell out their principles. They'll only need $250. But what some people do is they say, okay, I'll give you $250. My wife will give you $250. My kids will give you $250. And I'll get my contractors from, you know, that work for my company, those contractors, they'll give you money, their partners will give you money, and their employees will give you money. So it's, you know, a small number of corporate executives and developers can actually give you an enormous amount of money. And
what? And next door?
People.
Is that, is you're talking about? We had a fight over the property next door. The Roy who lived there died without a will.
Oh.
And we actually had people that tried to buy it and spent a year working through the county doing all the paperwork and got it appraised and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then an air finder showed up. Kind of out of nowhere at the last minute and found this obscure heir somewhere, and that heir gave them permission to get a realtor, and they took a property that was assessed at like $90,000, and a local kind of land guy who owns a lot of property around here, N-A name Carl Lasagna. Carl Lasagna showed up and offered, like, I think it was like $140,000 for the property. And when we found out that he put that offer in, we got his phone number and we called him and left a message and we said, we live next door and we've spent a year studying all the city ordinances and everything about what you can do. And we know that you own a lot of the apartments around here, and we've heard that that's what you want to do there. We just want to let you know that we know our rights and we're going to fight you, so you know, you might want to consider that before you buy the property. Well, he never called us back. He bought the property. He sends his architect over here with this blueprint to build this building, this huge building in this tiny little, maxing out every... Mm-hmm. And we knew that legally it was because the apartment building at the corner had a corner of his property where they kept their dumpster. We knew that mm-hmm. made him just short of being able to breeze through. Mm. So what he did was he made a deal with the owner of that he would... He bought it back, but he leased it to them for their dumpster, right? So nothing changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the architect shows up with this big building, and we're trying to rally the neighbors, you know, to try to get interested in this project. And then he says, can he come over and talk to us finally? And we realize, well, he must feel like we have some power, because why does he care about us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Mikey and I decided to let Frank do all the talking. And so Michael and I are just sitting here like this. That's a guy who obviously is used to not being interrupted. Mm-hmm. You know, he storms in here and he looks like he just always gets his way. And he just kept interrupting him and yelling right back, and he's turning purple, you know.
Wow.
He's like, you can see he's infuriated. What's he going to do, like hit Frank, you know? And so, you know, in the end, Frank, you know, I won't do it. We'll keep all the trees so you won't see the building, you know. How are you going to keep the trees there? They won't survive with this big building. No, we'll work everything out. You don't worry. So Frank said, well, if you show us something that we're happy with, and then we'll say okay to it, but we've got to be happy with whatever you show. Oh, I'm sure we can work something out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he basically gives us the same blueprint back with the trees in there.
Mm.
And we said, well, if you can get someone who is certified with trees,
mm-hmm.
right, putting something in writing guaranteeing that those trees will survive with that building there, and then we'll consider it. Well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to be able to get anybody to say that. And then he starts threatening us. Well, you know, that studio you built, which we had everything zoned, you know, we got all the paperwork, so we knew that was all bullshit. We said, well, if you're going to threaten us, you know, there really isn't anything to talk about. So we hang up on him. 2 minutes later, he pulls up in his car. Frank said he's a bad poker player because he throws this note in our door and drives away apologizing. And, you know, saying he's sure we can work things out and all this stuff. And Frank said, a bad poker player, because now we know that he thinks that it matters what we have to say about it. So what we did was, Michael does graphic design. That's like what he does. And so he took the blueprints. We took a bunch of pictures of our backyard. He took the blueprints and actually put the building in the picture, and we printed out color, big color photos with the building and without the building. We sent it to everybody, all the neighbors, the whatever the board is in the city that deals
zoning
with that, the zoning and adjustment board, him, Linda Mayo, just everybody that we could think of. We sent it to him. But when the neighbors saw the pictures, everybody wrote a letter, you know, and so he's, nothing's happened with that property for years, you know, and so I don't know what the point of the story was, just to show that you can do it.
Yeah, sometimes if people learn what their rights are and fight to defend them, sometimes they win.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
So people have to be alert and pay attention to what's going on and make sure to show up and fight their battles.
May. Maybe. We. This. Time. You. Maybe this time. Two. Also, that this might be another time that we fight the battle and win. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, that's the plan.
I hope so. It's tough to change people's minds, you know, but we really only have to change 3 people's minds, you know, because it was 7-1. So we don't have to change everybody's mind. We just have to change 3 people's minds. Because Donna didn't vote for it. She didn't vote against it, but she didn't vote for it. So if we can just get 3 people to change their minds.
Linda Mayo doesn't seem very... we've been in correspondence with her. Mm-hmm. And it's not encouraging.
But... Well, she's... I mean, she generally is relative, you know, is on the progressive side most of the time. So I think if she saw a good demonstration of, you know, what the legal issues are, if the ACLU examines this and decides that this is a good case, that could be a compelling argument. Because then they're going to have the practical element, do we really want the ACLU to be fighting us in court again, since they beat us last time? And so, you know, getting, that's part of, you know, alliances and coalitions, you know, if it's just one little group fighting, that's one thing, but if we can get other groups, you know, who are concerned, also involved, that helps.
Has, even if ACLU doesn't...
Yeah, then a private lawyer might decide that it's important enough to take the case. Certainly if they got paid, they would take the case. Mm. And it might be possible to convince somebody... You know, there's a lot of very liberal lawyers in Berkeley who care about civil rights and civil liberties. And it might be that one of them will...
Who will call?
Yeah, well, I think we have to sort of sort through who the... You know, who all the lawyers are, you know, and who might do it, and not charge a fortune.
Because
lawyers get paid pretty high salaries.
Yeah.
Most lawyers.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Okay. you, other city council members. You are invited on to the show to tea talk about whatever you want to talk about. This issue in particular. This issue in particular. BTV. To talk about BTV. Okay. You're invited on to talk about BTV. Okay, so it's, yes, we, how long has it been? Almost 2.5. Okay, we gotta end. The show's only 2.5 hours. So it's been, Chris Worthington. And you don't have to worry to edit. Right. It'll just, it should fit in the time slot. That's right. Yes.
Well, aren't you going to sort of do a teaser, you know, to advertise it, you know, with some kind of a strip tease act at the beginning and at the end? You know,
D.
We don't want this to be the lowest rated program of your entire year, you know.
We don't have time for explicit sexual content.
You mean I came all the way over here?
Well, go ahead. Take your clothes off.
It's all just going to be intellectual, political,
there you go.
Rhetoric.
Mike's going to get explicit. There you go, folks. A moment of explicit.
Well, I know there's many people in Berkeley who appreciate, you know, the fact that you're out there in the forefront and fighting this issue. And it's not just about you, you know, it's about a lot of people. And, you know, it's really about all of us. And even if they don't want to do exactly what you're doing, just having the right to have public access be what it can be.
Yes.
So you're quite a hero to the values of what Berkeley is all about. And you stood up to Jesse Helms once, and, you know, maybe this time we can all stand up to the city council and eventually win.
Or I am are you running for the city council? Kidding. Kidding. After going to one city council meeting, I don't know.
What is it they say? Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
You might get it.
Like, after, always seem to get what we wish for.
Yeah. That's good.
That's good. Yeah. Okay, it's a wrap. This that means that your player is going to stop and you have to hit play again. And if you only tuned in and saw part of the show and you're watching it now on Lover, we will be replaying it Sunday night. Not tomorrow, but the next day. After the wedding, so it will be probably 8:30, 9 p.m. Pacific time on Sunday. And then for people that live in Berkeley, it will air the third week in June. Okay, player's going to stop. Hit play again. Chris Worthington has been the guest.
Thank you very much.